the death of the vanquished. This is the Waterloo battlefield, about 200 miles northeast of Paris, in what today is Belgium. Here, Napoleon suffered his final defeat, but not before thousands of French and Englishmen gave their lives on a steamy summer day in July of 1815.
Right over there, on June 18, 1815, 74,000 French troops met 67,000 troops from Britain and other European nations.
The outcome was certainly in doubt. In fact, had Napoleon attacked a few hours earlier, he would probably have won the battle. But no matter who won or lost, back in London, Nathan Rothschild planned to use the opportunity to try to seize control over the British stock and bond market, and possibly even the Bank of England. Rothschild stationed a trusted agent, a man named Rothworth, on the north side of the battlefield, closer to the English Channel.
Once the battle had been decided, Rothworth took off to the Channel. He delivered the news to Nathan Rothschild a full 24 hours before Wellington's own courier. Rothschild hurried to the stock market and took up his usual position in front of an ancient pillar. All eyes were on him. The Rothschilds had a legendary communications network.
If Wellington had been defeated and Napoleon was loose on the continent again, Britain's financial situation would become grave indeed.
Rothschild looked saddened. He stood there motionless, eyes downcast. Then suddenly he began selling.
Other nervous investors saw that Rothschild was selling. It could only mean one thing. Napoleon must have won, Wellington must have lost. The market plummeted. Soon everyone was selling their consols, their British government bonds, and prices dropped sharply. But then Rothschild started secretly buying up the consols to his agents for only a fraction of their worth hours before.
Myth, legend, you say? 100 years later, the New York Times ran a story which said that Nathan's grandson had attempted to secure a court order to suppress a book with this stock market story in it. The Rothschild family claimed the story was untrue and libelous, but the court denied the Rothschild's request and ordered the family to pay all court costs.
What's even more interesting about this story is that some authors claim that the day after the Battle of Waterloo, in a matter of hours, Nathan Rothschild came to dominate not only the bond market, but the Bank of England as well. Whether or not the Rothschild family seized control of the Bank of England, the first privately owned central bank in a major European nation and the wealthiest, one thing is certain. By the mid-1800s, the Rothschilds were the richest family in the world, bar none. They dominated the new government bond markets and branched into other banks and industrial concerns.
In fact, the rest of the 19th century was known as the Age of the Rothschilds. Despite this overwhelming wealth, the family has generally cultivated an aura of invisibility. Although the family controls scores of industrial, commercial, mining, and tourist corporations, only a handful bear the Rothschild name. By the end of the 19th century, one expert estimated that the Rothschild family controlled half the wealth of the world. Whatever the extent of their vast wealth, it is reasonable to assume that their percentage of the world's wealth has increased since then. But since the turn of the century, the Rothschilds have cultivated the notion that their power has somehow waned even as their wealth increases. Meanwhile, back in Washington in 1816, just 1 year after Waterloo and Rothschild's alleged takeover of the Bank of England, the American Congress passed a bill permitting yet another privately owned central bank.
This bank was called the Second Bank of the United States. The new bank's charter was a copy of the previous bank's. The U.S. government would own 20% of the shares of the bank. Of course, the federal share was paid by the Treasury up front into the bank's coffers. Then, through the magic of fractional reserve lending, it was transformed into loans to private investors who then bought the remaining 80% of the shares.
Just as before, the primary stockholders remained a secret. But it is known that the largest block of shares, about one-third of the total, were sold to foreigners. As one observer put it, it is certainly no exaggeration to say that the Second Bank of the United States was rooted as deeply in Britain as it was in America. So, by 1816, some authors claim the Rothschilds had taken control over the Bank of England and backed a new, privately owned central bank in America as well. After 12 years of manipulations of the U.S. economy on the part of the Second Bank of the U.S., the American people had had just about enough. Opponents of the bank nominated a dignified senator from Tennessee, Andrew Jackson, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans, to run for president.
This is his home, the Hermitage.
No one gave Jackson a chance initially. The bank had long ago learned how the political process could be controlled with money. To the surprise and dismay of the money changers, Jackson was swept into office in 1828. Jackson was determined to kill the bank at the first opportunity and wasted no time in trying to do so. But the bank's 20-year charter didn't come up for renewal until 1836, the last year of his second term, if he could survive that long.
During his first term, Jackson contented himself with rooting out the bank's many minions from government service. He fired 2,000 of the 11,000 employees of the federal government. In 1832, with his re-election approaching, the bank struck an early blow, hoping Jackson would not want to stir up controversy. They asked Congress to pass a renewal bill 4 years early. Naturally, Congress complied, then sent it to the president for signing. But Jackson weighed in with both feet. Old Hickory, never a coward, vetoed the bill. His veto message is one of the great American documents. It clearly lays out the responsibility of the American government towards its citizens, rich and poor.
It is not our own citizens only who are to receive the bounty of our government. More than 8 million of the stock of this bank are held by foreigners. Is there no danger to our liberty and independence in a bank that, in its nature, has so little to bind it to our country? Controlling our currency, receiving our public monies, and holding thousands of our citizens independent would be more formidable and dangerous than a military power of the enemy. If government would confine itself to equal protection and, as heaven does its rain, shower its favor alike on the high and the low, the rich and the poor, it would be an unqualified blessing. In the act before me, there seems to be a wide and unnecessary departure from these just principles.
Later that year, in July 1832, Congress was unable to override Jackson's veto. Now Jackson had to stand for re-election. Jackson took his argument directly to the people. For the first time in U.S. history, Jackson took his presidential campaign on the road. Before then, presidential candidates stayed at home and looked presidential. His campaign slogan was Jackson and no bank. The National Republican Party ran Senator Henry Clay against Jackson. Despite the fact that the bankers poured over $3 million into Clay's campaign, Jackson was reelected by a landslide in November of 1832. Despite his presidential victory, Jackson knew the battle was only beginning. The hydra of corruption is only scotched, not dead, said the newly elected president. Jackson ordered his new Secretary of Treasury, Lewis McClain, to start removing the government's deposits from the Second Bank and start placing them in state banks. But McClain refused to do so. Jackson fired him and appointed William J. DeWayne as the new Secretary of the Treasury. DeWayne also refused to comply with the president's request. And so Jackson fired him as well, and then appointed Roger B. Taney to the office. Taney did withdraw government funds from the bank starting on October 1, 1833. Jackson was jubilant. "I have it chained. I'm ready with screws to draw every tooth and then the stump." But the bank was not yet done fighting. Its head, Nicholas Biddle, used his influence to get the Senate to reject Taney's nomination. Then, in a rare show of arrogance, Biddle threatened to cause a depression if the bank was not rechartered.
This worthy president thinks that because he has scalped Indians and imprisoned judges, he is to have his way with the bank. He is mistaken.
Next, in an unbelievable fit of honesty for a central banker, Biddle admitted that the bank was going to make money scarce to force Congress to restore the bank.
"Nothing but widespread suffering will produce any effect on Congress. Our only safety is in pursuing a steady course of firm restriction. And I have no doubt that such a course will ultimately lead to restoration of the currency and the recharter of the bank."
What a stunning revelation. Here was the pure truth revealed with shocking clarity. Biddle intended to use the money contraction power of the bank to cause a massive depression until America gave in. Unfortunately, this has happened time and time again throughout U.S. history and is about to happen again in today's world. Nicholas Biddle made good on his threat. The bank sharply contracted the money supply by calling in old loans and refusing to extend new ones. A financial panic ensued, followed by a deep depression. Naturally, Biddle blamed Jackson for the crash, saying that it was caused by the withdrawal of federal funds from the bank. Unfortunately, his plan worked well. Wages and prices sagged. Unemployment soared along with business bankruptcies. The nation quickly went into an uproar. Newspaper editors blasted Jackson in editorials. The bank threatened to withhold payments, which then could be made directly to key politicians for their support. Within only months, Congress assembled in what was called the panic session.
6 months after he had withdrawn funds from the bank, Jackson was officially censured by a resolution which passed the Senate by a vote of 26-20. It was the first time a president had ever been censured by Congress. Jackson lashed out at the bank, "You are a den of vipers. I intend to rout you out, and by eternal God, I will rout you out."
America's fate teetered on a knife edge. If Congress could muster enough votes to override Jackson's veto, the bank would be granted another 20-year monopoly or more over America's money, time enough to consolidate its already great power. Then a miracle occurred. The governor of Pennsylvania came out supporting President Jackson and strongly criticized the bank. On top of that, Biddle had been caught boasting in public about the bank's plan to crash the economy. Suddenly, the tide shifted. In April of 1834, the House of Representatives voted 134-82 against rechartering the bank. This was followed up by an even more lopsided vote to establish a special committee to investigate whether the bank had caused the crash. When the investigating committee arrived at the bank's door in Philadelphia, armed with a subpoena to examine the books, Biddle refused to give them up, nor would he allow inspection of correspondence with congressmen relating to their personal loans and advances he'd made to them. He also refused to testify before the committee back in Washington.
On January 8, 1835, Jackson paid off the final installment on the national debt, which had been necessitated by allowing the banks to issue currency for government bonds rather than simply issuing treasury notes without such debt. He was the only president to ever pay off the debt.
A few weeks later, on January 30, 1835, an assassin by the name of Richard Lawrence tried to shoot President Jackson, but by the grace of God, both pistols misfired. Lawrence was later found not guilty by reason of insanity. After his release, he bragged to friends that powerful people in Europe had put him up to the task and promised to protect him if he were caught. The following year, when its charter ran out, the Second Bank of the United States ceased functioning as the nation's central bank. Biddle was later arrested and charged with fraud, He was tried and acquitted, but died shortly thereafter while still tied up in civil suits.
After his second term as president, Jackson retired here to the Hermitage outside of Nashville to live out his life. He is still remembered here for his determination to kill the bank. In fact, he killed it so well that it took the money changers 77 years to undo the damage. When asked what his most important accomplishment had been, Jackson replied, "I killed the bank."
Unfortunately, even Jackson failed to grasp the entire picture and its root cause. Although Jackson had killed the central bank, the most insidious weapon of the money changers, fractional reserve banking, remained in use by the numerous state-chartered banks. This fueled economic instability in the years before the Civil War. Still, the central bankers were out, and as a result, America thrived as it expanded westward.
During this time, the principal money changers struggled to regain their lost centralized power, but to no avail. Then, finally, they reverted to the old central bankers' formula, war to create debt and dependency. If they couldn't get their central bank any other way, America could be brought to its knees by plunging it into a civil war, just as they had done in 1812 after the first bank of the United States was not rechartered. 1 month after the inauguration of Abraham Lincoln, the first shots of the American Civil War were fired here at Fort Sumter, South Carolina, on April 12, 1861. Certainly, slavery was a cause for the Civil War, but not the primary cause. Lincoln knew that the economy of the South depended upon slavery, and so before the Civil War, he had no intention of eliminating it. Lincoln had put it this way in his inaugural address only 1 month earlier.
"I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it now exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so."
Even after the first shots were fired here at Fort Sumter, Lincoln continued to insist that the Civil War was not about the issue of slavery.
"My paramount objective is to save the Union, and it is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it."
So what was the Civil War all about? There were many factors at play. Northern industrialists had used protective tariffs to prevent the Southern states from buying cheaper European goods. Europe retaliated by stopping cotton imports from the South. The Southern states were in a double financial bind. They were forced to pay more for most of the necessities of life while their income from cotton exports plummeted. The South was angry. But there were other factors at work. The money changers were still stung by America's withdrawal from their control 25 years earlier. Since then, America's wildcat economy had made the nation rich, a bad example for the rest of the world. The central bankers now saw an opportunity to split the rich new nation, to divide and conquer by war. Was this just some sort of wild conspiracy theory at the time? Well, let's take a look at what a well-placed observer of the scene had to say at the time. His name was Otto von Bismarck, Chancellor of Germany, the man who united the German state a few years later. The division of the United States into federations of equal force was decided long before the Civil War by the high financial powers of Europe. These bankers were afraid that the United States, if they remained as one bloc and as one nation, would attain economic and financial independence, which would upset their financial domination over the world. Within months after the first shots here at Fort Sumter, the central bankers loaned Napoleon III of France, the nephew of the Waterloo Napoleon, 210 million francs to seize Mexico and station troops along the southern border of the U.S., taking advantage of their war to violate the Monroe Doctrine and return Mexico to colonial rule. No matter what the outcome of the Civil War, a weakened America, heavily indebted to the money changers, would open up Central and South America once again to European colonization and domination. The very thing America's Monroe Doctrine had forbade in 1823. At the same time, Great Britain moved 11,000 troops into Canada and positioned them menacingly along America's northern border. The British fleet went to war alert should their quick intervention be called for.
Lincoln knew he was in a double bind. That's why he agonized over the fate of the Union. There was a lot more to it than just differences between the North and the South. That's why his emphasis was always on Union and not merely the defeat of the South. But Lincoln needed money to win. In 1861, Lincoln and his Secretary of Treasury, Salmon T. Chase, went to New York to apply for the necessary loans. The money changers, anxious to see the Union fail, offered loans at 24 to 36% interest. Lincoln said thanks, but no thanks, and returned to Washington. Lincoln sent for an old friend, Colonel Dick Taylor of Chicago, and put him on the problem of financing the war. During one meeting, Lincoln asked Taylor what he'd discovered. Taylor put it this way.
"Why, Lincoln, that is easy. Just get Congress to pass a bill authorizing the printing of full legal tender treasury notes, and pay your soldiers with them, and go ahead and win your war with them also." When Lincoln asked if the people of the United States would accept the notes, Taylor said, "The people, or anyone else, will not have any choice in the matter if you make them full legal tender. They will have the full sanction of the government and be just as good as any money, as Congress is given that express right by the Constitution." So that's exactly what Lincoln did. In 1862-63, he printed up $450 million worth of the new bills. In order to distinguish them from other banknotes in circulation, he printed them in green ink on the back side. That's why the notes were called greenbacks. With this new money, Lincoln paid the troops and bought their supplies. During the course of the war, nearly $450 million worth of greenbacks were printed at no interest to the federal government.
Lincoln understood who was really pulling the strings and what was at stake for the American people. This is how he explained his rationale.
"The government should create, issue, and circulate all the currency and credit needed to satisfy the spending power of the government and the buying power of consumers. The privilege of creating and issuing money is not only the supreme prerogative of government, but it is the government's greatest creative opportunity. By the adoption of these principles, the taxpayers will be saved immense sums of interest. Money will cease to be master and become the servant of humanity."
A truly incredible editorial in the London Times explained the central banker's attitude towards Lincoln's greenbacks.
"If this mischievous financial policy, which has its origins in North America, shall become indurated down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off debts and be without debt. It will have all the money necessary to carry on its commerce. It will become prosperous without precedent in the history of the world. The brains and wealth of all countries will go to North America. That country must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the globe."
The scheme was effective. So effective that the next year, 1863, with federal and Confederate troops beginning to mass for the decisive battle of the Civil War, and the Treasury in need of further congressional authority to issue more greenbacks, Lincoln allowed the bankers to push through the National Bank Act. These new national banks would operate under a virtual tax-free status and collectively had the exclusive monopoly power to create the new form of money, banknotes. Though greenbacks continued to circulate, their numbers were not increased.
But most importantly, from this point on, the entire U.S. money supply would be created out of debt by bankers buying U.S. government bonds and issuing them for reserve for banknotes. As historian John Kenneth Galbraith explained it,
in numerous years following the war, the federal government ran a heavy surplus. It could not, however, pay off its debt, retire its securities, because to do so meant there would be no bonds to back the national banknotes. To pay off the debt was to destroy the money supply.
Later in 1863, Lincoln got some unexpected help from Tsar Alexander II of Russia. The Tsar, like Bismarck in Germany, knew what the international money changers were up to and had steadfastly refused to let them set up a central bank in Russia. If America survived and was able to remain out of their clutches, the Tsar's position would remain secure. If the bankers were successful at dividing America and giving the pieces back to Great Britain and France, both nations under control of their central banks, eventually they would threaten Russia again.
So the Tsar gave orders that if either England or France actively intervened and gave aid to the South, Russia would consider such action as a declaration of war. He did the same with part of his Pacific fleet and sent them to port in San Francisco. Lincoln was reelected the next year, 1864. Had he lived, he would surely have killed the National Bank's money monopoly extracted from him during the war. On November 21, 1864, he wrote a friend the following.
The money power preys upon the nation in times of peace and conspires against it in times of adversity. It is more despotic than monarchy, more insolent than autocracy, more selfish than bureaucracy.
Shortly before Lincoln was murdered, his former Secretary of Treasury, Salmon P. Chase, bemoaned his role in helping secure the passage of the National Banking Act only 1 year earlier.
My agency in promoting the passage of the National Banking Act was the greatest financial mistake in my life. It has built up a monopoly which affects every interest in the country.
On April 14, 1865, 41 days after his second inauguration and just 5 days after Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, Lincoln was shot by John Wilkes Booth at Ford's Theater.
Bismarck, Chancellor of Germany, lamented the death of Abraham Lincoln.
The death of Lincoln was a disaster for Christendom. There was no man in the United States great enough to wear his boots. I fear that foreign bankers, with their craftiness and torturous tricks, will entirely corrupt the exuberant riches of America and use it systematically to corrupt modern civilization. They will not hesitate to plunge the whole of Christendom into wars and